being aware of the signs and symptoms of low electrolyte status. Lethargy, fatigue, brain fog are early stage pieces. When we start getting cramping, you're really far down the track. If we are deficient in sodium, it's virtually impossible for the kidneys to get out ahead of that. Sodium and potassium are really kind of the energy currency of life. Dietary change is so difficult anyway, but if you feel like absolute garbage also, you're really stacking the deck unfavorably.
Welcome to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast, where we meet the world's top experts to explore the secrets of health, mindset, longevity, and so much more. Are you ready to take charge of your existence and biohack your life? This show is for you. Please keep in mind, we're not dispensing medical advice and are not responsible for any outcomes you may experience from implementing the tactics lying herein. Are you ready? Let's do this. Welcome back to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. Okay, friends, Rob Wolf is my favorite, so I am so thrilled to share today's episode with you guys. Like I say all throughout this episode, and I have said before, Rob Wolf is basically the reason I'm doing what I'm doing today. I read his book, The Paleo Solution, and here we are. I had Rob on the show before, and we dive deep into regenerative agriculture, as well as some other health-related things, but today's episode, we are focusing on electrolytes, such an important health topic that I think people have oftentimes a very basic understanding of. It was so exciting to dive deep, deep, deep into all of it with Rob. If after listening to the show, you would like to try the Element electrolyte supplements, Rob is being so kind and he is giving my audience free samples. Yes, completely free. You just go to drinklmnt.com/Melanie Avalon and that will get you a free sampler pack. All you pay is shipping. And if you don't like them, they will even reimburse you the shipping. It's that incredible. And I'm just going to take another moment of gratitude recording this intro about how in awe I am of my life. I can't believe that I get to interview people that I so look up to who are also just genuine human beings. Guys, I'm just so grateful, and I hope you guys enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. The show notes for today's episode will be at melanieavalon.com/electrolytes. Those show notes will have a full transcript, so definitely check that out. There will be two episode giveaways for this episode. One will be in my Facebook group, IF Biohackers, Intermittent Fasting plus Real Foods plus Life. Comment something you learned or something that resonated with you on the pinned post to enter to win something I love. And then there will be a second giveaway on my Instagram. Again, check out the announcement post for this episode and comment something there to win. Hey friends, did you know that one of our largest sources of toxic exposure each and every day is through our skincare and makeup? It is so frightening the effects these compounds can have on our health. So we put these products on to help us look better, and yet they actually can be aging us, contributing to health issues, fertility issues, thyroid issues, mood issues, and ready for something potentially even more shocking? A lot of these endocrine disruptors are actually obesogens, meaning they cause your body to gain weight and make it harder to lose weight. That's right, your skincare and makeup may be hindering your weight loss goals. Europe has banned thousands of these compounds, and the US has banned around a dozen. There's even a loophole from the 1960s that allows companies to put whatever they want in their products, and they don't even have to tell you. That's why I am overwhelmingly careful about the skincare and makeup that I use. But here's the thing, it can be hard to find skincare and makeup that is non-toxic and actually works. And then on top of that, that actually has all the products you need. I have found two companies, I am obsessed with their standards and use them every single day of my life and cannot recommend them enough. That's Counter, formerly known as Beauty Counter, and Crunchy. Both of these companies have incredible standards when it comes to what they put in their products. You can truly feel good about using them and they actually work. For Counter products, go to melanieavalon.com/counter. And for Crunchy products, go to crunchy.com. That's crunchy.com/Melanie Avalon. New Crunchy customers can use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 to get 10% off. You'll also receive something special from me after your first order. I also highly recommend joining both of their loyalty programs. It's completely free to join, and with every purchase, you'll earn credit as well as other fun goodies. For all the latest updates, new products, specials, deals, and fun things for me, because yes, I love giving things away, get on my email list. That's at melanieavalon.com/cleanbeauty. You can also get text updates when you text skincare to 877-861-8318. That's skincare to 877-861-8318. So again, to shop with me and get a free gift from me after your first order, go to melanieavalon.com/counter and also crunchy.com/melanieavalon. And new customers use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 at Crunchy to get 10% off site-wide. And again, definitely join their free loyalty programs to earn credit on every order. Hey friends, exciting news. My Avalon X Spirulina is back in stock and now at a reduced price. Plus you get free shipping and my coupon code works on top of that sale price. Spirulina is honestly one of the most nutrient-dense things that you can put in your body in a whole foods, easy to eat form. It's a blue-green algae, which is a complete vegan protein packed with an incredible array of nutrients. We are talking 100% of your daily hard-to-get vitamin K, 625% of vitamin B12, over 1,000% of vitamin A, 86% of chromium, 27% of vitamin B2, plus so much more, including iron, GLA, the powerful antioxidant superoxide dismutase, and even glutathione. In fact, spirulina is so uniquely nutritious that it was actually studied by NASA to support the astronauts. I searched high and low to find the very best spirulina out there. Ours comes from a wonderful, sustainable, clean, environmentally friendly production facility in Hawaii. Not Thailand, Hawaii. And then on top of that, we did our own third-party testing for over 70 pesticides, heavy metals, toxins, all the things. This is the cleanest spirulina out there. And with spirulina, you can simplify your supplement routine and support your nutrition in one easy step. The tablets are super versatile. You can swallow them whole, blend them into smoothies, crush them up, or honestly, just eat them like I do. And again, we were out of stock, but now Avalon X Spirulina is finally back in stock at a reduced price, and my coupon code MelanieAvalon works on top of that too. Plus, you get free shipping. Just go to avalonx.us/spirulina and use the coupon code MelanieAvalon to get 10% off our new reduced price plus free shipping. That's avalonx.us/spirulina with the coupon code MelanieAvalon. All right, without further ado, please enjoy this wonderful conversation with Rob Wolf. Hi, friends. Welcome back to the show. I am so incredibly excited about the conversation that I am about to have. This is a true statement when I say that I have had over 100 guests, all incredible guests on this show, but today's guest is my favorite guest out of all of them. I have done one episode before with this fabulous human being, but I will retell briefly my story about everything. So basically, the reason or a foundational reason that I became obsessed with the whole holistic health movement and the power of how our food affects our biology and our constitution was because I read a book called The Paleo Solution. I did not anticipate that that book would change my life, but it honestly really, really did. I don't even have it anymore because I lent it out and never got it back. But basically, that book was written by the fabulous Rob Wolf. I became obsessed with his work. At the time, it was called The Paleo Solution Podcast. I would listen to every single episode. Now it's called Healthy Rebellion Radio for listeners who would like to listen now. After The Paleo Solution, Rob released Wired to Eat, which was all about how you react to different foods and different carb intakes, which is really eye-opening. I really, really recommend that book as well. And then most recently, he released Sacred Cow, which I find myself recommending that book all the time. If you want to really get a nuanced, comprehensive view of really the implications of animal husbandry and how animals affect the environment, it's mind-blowing. It's very eye-opening. The last episode we did, we really dived deep into it, so I'll put a link to that in the show notes. I was actually interviewing Gary Taub recently for his new book, and at the end, he was saying that basically his one concern with the keto low-carb diet is the effect on the environment, and I was like, Have you read Sacred Cow? So I basically just throw it at everybody.
The answer to that is no, he hasn't. Gary and I have gone around and around on this topic. Yeah.
He was like, I read parts of it. I was like, well, read all of it, please, and report back. So, basically I just am forever grateful to your work, Rob. And the topic of today's show is electrolytes. And that is because Rob Wolf has an incredible product called Element. It's an electrolyte supplement. Well, I've been promoting it to my audience and I have been getting so much incredible feedback, especially from people who do low carb diets, keto diets, fasting, and the profound effect that taking electrolytes, specifically Element, has had on their health and their experience of their diet and issues they might have been having. On top of that, I've been getting so many questions about electrolytes. So I figured it was time to just have a conversation about all of this. So that was really, really long. Rob, thank you so much for being here.
Huge honor to be here. And I am so honored and tickled that I've had some influence on your amazing impact in this health and wellness space. So it makes doing this very much worthwhile knowing that I've had some impact there. So thank you.
Yes, majorly. I am just forever grateful. Listeners are probably ridiculously familiar with you, but for those who are not, you are a former research biochemist. Those books I mentioned, the first two are New York Times and Wall Street Journal best-selling books, and you actually co-founded the first and fourth CrossFit affiliate gyms in the world, which is a really cool fun fact. But in any case, so to get into today's conversation, I have so many questions, but I guess a good place to start is I'm really, really curious. So you have Element, a product line now. What was the inciting incident for deciding to focus on electrolytes? Like, did you have an epiphany one day? Was it a slow realization? Like, what led to where you are now with promoting the importance of electrolytes?
Oh man, it's a really good question. The genesis story is interesting, and even though I'm pretty good at like the biochemistry, the metabolic pathways around ketogenic diets, and just kind of, you know, human performance metabolism at large, but you never know everything. And I had been, so backing up a little bit more, 23 years ago, I was super sick from ulcerative colitis. I was down to, I'm about 165 pounds, reasonably good shape for a getting to be old dude, but I was down to 125 pounds from my ulcerative colitis because I just was absorbing nothing that I ate. And at that time, I was eating a low-fat vegan diet, which I think can work for some folks. It absolutely does not work for me. And I was pretty much at like desperation point. And through kind of a long series of circumstances, this idea of a low-carb, paleo, ancestral-type diet got on my radar. And I tried that. And for me, it was a lifesaver. And so we fast forward 23 years later, I do really well in most things eating a lower carb diet, particularly my gut health and kind of blood sugar regulation. Like, I've tried reintroducing carbs in a variety of ways and safe starch and all this stuff. And man, it really doesn't work all that well. And I know some people, the reintroduction of carbs goes great. For some people, it doesn't. But I've also always, you know, throughout most of my life, have been interested in things like CrossFit and Muay Thai and Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, which are all very glycolytic, energy demanding activities. And historically, a low carb diet is really tough to pair with these super high intensity glycolytic type sports or activities. And so I had struggled for years trying to figure out, how do I eat in a way so that I feel good day to day, but then I have the energy to do the activities I want to do? And so I tried carb cycling and pre and post workout carbs and different things like that. And it worked okay, but none of it was really that great. And I continued poking around, looking around online for people that were low carb, but also doing Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And I noticed that there were a number of women who were competing at a high level in jiu-jitsu, and we're also, you know, their profiles, you know, it would say like keto mama jiu-jitsu 119, you know, or whatever. And I'm like, oh, okay. So I'd start looking at this stuff, and they were all following this program called Keto Gains. And I started kind of poking around that scene, and the two guys that founded that, Tyler Cartwright and Luis Villasenor, struck me as really reasonable people, very, very smart, very dedicated to the folks that they work with. They do these multiple times per year online boot camps where they focus on a appropriate protein, low carb, keto, you know, kind of ketogenic diet with smart strength training and a lot of community support and whatnot. And they just had stunning results, but you know, with weight loss and with health improvements with people. So I kind of stalked these guys and started hanging out with them, managed to bamboozle them into being a speaker at one of their first in-person events. And I do what most people should do when they're you know, interacting with someone who's very good at something. I ask them to kind of assess what I'm up to and figure out if there was a way that I could you know, better fuel my activities. And they looked at everything I was doing and they're like, you know, you look pretty good, but I suspect that you're not getting enough electrolytes, specifically sodium. And what I did was I ignored their advice at first. I'm like, oh, no, I salt my food. I'm not afraid of sodium. And they're very patient people. And so probably a good year went along and we started working together on a bunch of different projects. Like we worked on a health initiative for the Chickasaw Nation and a bunch of really cool things. But I kept whining and complaining about my jujitsu performance and not really recovering from activity and whatnot. And they would say, hey, I really think those electrolytes are important, you know? And finally, one day they were like, no, man, really, listen, do us this favor. Weigh and measure everything you're eating, including your electrolytes, like everything you're adding to your food when you add some salt, measure it, weigh it, add it into something like Chronometer, which tells you the protein, carbs, fat, but also like the sodium, potassium, magnesium, calcium. It gives you a very comprehensive picture of what's going on. And let's see where your electrolytes are, especially sodium. And I was less than half of what they were recommending on sodium. And so I bumped that up. They had this thing that they called KetoAid, which was some regular table salt, some potassium chloride, which goes by the brand name No Salt, and some magnesium citrate, some lemon juice, some stevia, shake it up, drink it. And I felt amazing. Like it was literally like a light switch was flipped. And when you think about the fact that every thought we have, every muscle impulse that we create is driven by sodium potassium pumps. And so if your electrolytes are off, it's going to dramatically affect the way that you look, feel, and perform. And just as an example, when somebody ends up in the emergency room, the very first things that doctors look at is their pH and their electrolytes. Because if your pH is off one way or the other, you can get very, very sick or you can die. If your electrolytes are off one way or the other, you can get very, very sick and you can die. And so like pH and electrolytes are arguably the most tightly regulated, you know, physiological parameters in our whole system. So once I figured this out, I was like, guys, electrolytes are super important. They're like, yeah, I know. We've been telling people this for like 10 years, you know? And so this is where even if you individually are regarded as an expert on a topic, it's really good to shut up and just listen to other people around you, because I could have saved myself another year of struggling. And what's interesting, I guess, in this, and I know I'm just kind of wandering all over the place, but if somebody is put on a medically supervised ketogenic diet, say like for epilepsy, their dietitian will make certain that the person gets at least 5 grams of sodium per day by hook or by crook, whether it's pickles or chicken bouillon cubes or, you know, whatever it is, because there's a really clear understanding that when people eat a low carb diet, their insulin levels decrease, which causes them to decrease a hormone called aldosterone. And aldosterone causes us to retain sodium. So there's this phenomena called the naturesis of fasting. When people are in a low carb state or they're fasting, they lose water and sodium like crazy. And if you don't replenish that, people will be super lethargic, lightheaded. They have a high heart rate. Their sleep is disturbed. This can lead into thyroid issues and things that we like to call adrenal fatigue and whatnot. And so this was really kind of the genesis of this whole idea. But we didn't have this idea initially of making a product. What we did is we made a free downloadable guide for how to make this KetoAid product. And within about 6 months, we had over 500,000 downloads of this thing. And people were just going crazy. They're like, the keto aid is amazing. Thank you so much. But when I travel, the 3 bags of white powder I travel with really concerns the TSA, you know? And so people started asking us, would you ever think about doing like a convenient product that I could take with me? And it really wasn't on our radar, but there was a massive amount of interest. And we were seeing all of these super common side effects or difficulties of doing dietary shift. And it doesn't have to be a low carb diet. Even if somebody just goes from eating a very poor diet to say like a Mediterranean type diet, they experience a lot of these same symptoms, the fatigue and lethargy and everything, because they're dropping their insulin levels. They're going to have some shifting around of their electrolyte and sodium status and whatnot. And we just saw all of these people, you know, dietary change is so difficult anyway because of social issues and, you know, psychological issues and whatnot. But if you feel like absolute garbage also, and you have no energy and you just kind of hate your life, like you're really stacking the deck unfavorably for people. So we realized that if we could help people bridge that gap, you know, when they're initiating dietary change, or if they've been in this scene a long time, but they're trying to exercise at a high level and whatnot, that they really need more electrolytes, in particular sodium. And the sodium piece is really something that's very different. Most electrolytes lead with potassium, and we do see potassium as being very important. But what we really drive people towards is eating a minimally processed whole food diet. And generally, they get most of the potassium they need in that scenario, but they get virtually none of the sodium. So that's why Element is so sodium heavy relative to the other constituents. And then just, I will shut up here in a minute, but when we started putting this together, we weren't sure at all if this idea around Element would go. And so the first several flavors we put out, like the citrus salt, like the raw unflavored and the lemon habanero, they were all formulated as drink mix bases also. So like if we failed as an electrolyte company, we were going to pivot and become like a drink mixer company. And fortunately, it's gone well on both, you know, kind of directions with that. But we didn't just sit down, you know, with this idea that we were going to spin up an electrolyte company. And it was really recognizing my own personal need, which Tyler and Luis had recognized this need in the folks that they had been working with for years. And then when we had this kind of premium offer or freemium offering where we gave this mix it yourself, you know, homebrew thing away. And we still do that. Like when people are, well, I don't know if I want to spend the money on this. We're like, great, just download the free guide. Make sure you get your electrolytes on point. Eat some pickles, eat some olives. Like, just make sure you get enough sodium and everything's going to be good. So that's kind of the genesis story. And it's been really cool because we didn't need to spin up any type of like magical stories. You know, like our salt is this secret salt from like Pakistan and there's only one source of it. And it's got this amazing mineral mix. Like, we didn't have to do any goofy marketing stuff like that. It's like, no, you probably need more sodium. And here's a million different ways that you could get it. But Element tastes really good and it's super convenient. So we'll send you a free one if you want to check it out. And kind of like any good drug dealer, first one's free and then people get hooked. And then just kind of off to the races from there.
Oh my goodness. That is so incredible. And you touched on so many things. I have so many questions. So historically, as hunter-gatherers, when we were hunting and gathering, you know, no processed foods, nothing from today, what was the average sodium intake?
That's a great question. And one part to this story is that the way that meat is processed in the Western world, animals are butchered and they're bled as part of the process. And if you look at the sodium content of most mammals while they're alive, and this is spread throughout their whole body, like the teeth, the hair, the nails, the whole thing, but they contain about 4-4.5 grams of sodium per kilogram of weight on average of the animal. But when you look at the sodium content of just meat, it's about 1.5 to 2 grams of sodium. And this is because when the animals are bled, and it's interesting, a lot of cultures, like I lived in Southeast Asia for a while, Central America for a while, and people will make things like blood pudding and blood cheese where they collect the blood when the The animals are butchered and they eat that stuff. And the highest sodium concentrations in a mammal is in the extracellular fluid. But when an animal dies, the potassium, which is in higher concentrations inside the cell, tend to leak out, and the sodium, which is in higher concentrations outside the cell, tend to leak in and they equilibrate. And so I think that that's one place that hunter-gatherers likely obtained a significantly larger amount of sodium in their diet. And then the other part of this is that when we look at historical kind of analysis of the way that hunter-gatherers lived and also contemporarily living hunter-gatherers, they don't drink massive amounts of fluids. And I think that that's actually one of the kind of wacky things. Like, you sound like a crazy person to say maybe we would be better off not drinking eight ounce glasses of water per day. But just recently, there were some pretty high level, you know, folks that have been walking that notion back, because what they're finding is that people end up in this state called hyponatremia, where their sodium levels are too low relative to the amount of water that they're consuming. And folks may be familiar with things like sorority or different like college hazing when people are joining a fraternity or sorority, people in military, boot camps, marathoners, triathletes. But if folks overconsume water, they can dilute their sodium to such a degree that they can become sick, possibly hospitalized, or even die. And I think some of the problem that we experience today is just, you know, like, I love drinking a cup of coffee in the morning, but a cup isn't actually like 6 or 8 ounces like a cup is supposed to be. It's whatever container, you know, I can fill full with fluid. And that is enough to start diluting your sodium levels. And then you start feeling kind of foggy headed and fatigued and whatnot. So I think in that ancestral environment, both animals and humans are very, very good at finding things like salt licks. They tended to gravitate towards more salt-rich foods. And then also they weren't consuming massive amounts of beverages throughout the day, which is ironic that, you know, we're kind of plugging that gap with a beverage. But I think that that is a way that we can, you know, kind of do some of the more socially accepted or habit-based things of like having a drink to sip on throughout the day and whatnot, but we just make sure that there's actually some electrolytes in there and then we don't end up with the same problems.
Hi, friends. Guess what? Have you ever wanted a dating app that takes into account your dietary preferences? Things like fasting, whether or not you're paleo, keto, vegan, omnivore, junk food lover, whatever it may be. Or maybe it's important to you that you date a fellow wine drinker or a coffee lover, or you're sober curious and don't want drinks to be the first date. Speaking of first dates, did you know that the top 4 first dates all involve food or drink? That's right, food and drink are super important for compatibility. That's why I'm making a dating app to address this. It's basically like any other mainstream dating app, except you can filter by dietary preference. For all of the launch information, including how to get it and launch specials, get on the email list. For that, go to cravingdating.com. Again, that's cravingdating.com. Through that list, we'll be sending updates, information about the launch, and even let you guys weigh in on the development. So again, go now to cravingdating.com. I recently did two different episodes all just on water. It was because we were talking before this, I've been researching deuterium depletion. Something I learned in those episodes was that a large portion of our water is created internally. We don't drink it. And that really blew my mind. Like, that was a huge, huge reframe for me. With everything that you just said with the hunter-gatherers, do you think that the amount of sodium they were consuming was similar to what we consume today? Or if you're eating processed foods, do you think that's more than what they would have been consuming?
It would probably be significantly more than what any hunter-gatherer was consuming. I mean, sodium is the only kind of micronutrient that we have a taste for. Potassium chloride has a flavor and it tastes awful. Magnesium citrate has a flavor and it kind of tastes awful. But we have five, you know, sweet, salty, sour, umami. One of them is salt. And so sodium is generally comparatively rare and hard to find in nature. And so it is interesting that most organisms have a taste and a drive for salt. And also salt containing substances usually have some other nutrients that go with them and whatnot. But usually when we look at the reconstructed diets of hunter-gatherers, it was definitely not that like 5 grams of sodium per day level that we've been recommending within, say, like this kind of low carb world. But it also looks like that doesn't make as big a point so long as we get adequate potassium and the other kind of profile of minerals is pretty good.
Do individual electrolytes affect individual processes, or is it more about the overall balance of all of them? On a granular level, what do electrolytes actually do? I know you mentioned like the potassium pump and things like that, but are they a nutrient or are they a signaling molecule? Like, what are they literally doing?
I guess both in some ways. So I'm just going to focus on the metal ions in this. So all of the electrolytes that we would consider would be sodium, potassium, magnesium, calcium, chloride, bicarbonate, and then maybe phosphorus, phosphate, but I'm not really going to look at the anions, the chloride and all that type of stuff, really going to focus on the metal ions. But so like calcium is a critical piece of muscle contraction. It plays a role in like the actin-myosin cross-linking and when those actin-myosin heads interact and kind of, you know, do that sliding filament thing when we contract muscles. Calcium is critical in the clotting cascade. So like if we get a cut or a thrombic event, calcium is critical in that process. Magnesium is critical in ATP production. It helps to kind of orient the structure of ATP in such a way that the enzymes properly work in both building and degrading ATP. And so those are important electrolytes, but they play very, in my mind, kind of secondary roles relative to sodium and potassium. And sodium and potassium are really kind of the energy currency of life. Like if people remember college, high school biology, TCA cycle, Krebs cycle, the electron transport chain, all that type of stuff, all of that is being driven by sodium potassium pumps. So our body will concentrate sodium in higher amounts outside the cell, potassium in higher amounts inside the cell. And that gradient helps to then drive the electron transport gradient, the hydrogen ion gradient, which occurs in the mitochondria. And so the sodium potassium pump really is the big, big deal in the story. And I mean, all these things are important. Magnesium is important. Calcium is important. Modern folks who eat a processed diet tend to overconsume sodium relative to these other constituents, and that's part of why sodium's had kind of a bad rap, and we can kind of dig into that a little bit later. But it's worth noting, though, that if we have adequate sodium, in general, people do well sorting everything else out. If the individual is a diabetic, hypertensive, they have high blood pressure, then we need to do some things. Like just loading them with more sodium is not really going to help them all that much. But interestingly, allowing them to continue eating a poor diet and restricting their sodium also doesn't really help them all that much. Ironically, like we need to really modify their diet and lifestyle in a way that improves insulin sensitivity they go through some of that naturesis of fasting and get to a normal spot with their blood pressure and their electrolyte status. But I would make the case that sodium is really kind of the linchpin in this whole story, because if we get a little bit too much sodium, within about 15 or 20 minutes, our kidneys have filtered it and sorted that out. But if we are deficient in sodium, it's virtually impossible for the kidneys to get out ahead of that. And they will begin to shed potassium and magnesium. Then it will stimulate hormonal signaling where we pull sodium out of the bone. But when we pull the sodium out of the bone to buffer our extracellular fluids, we also pull calcium out of the bone. So this is thought to be one of the drivers of osteoporosis. Osteopenia is low sodium intake, which then drives the tendency to remove both sodium and calcium out of the bone. So it's a really dynamic process, and it's maybe self-serving because we put together element to be very sodium forward, but we didn't do that. It's kind of funny, folks on the interwebs will say, oh, I like the product, but you really got the formulation wrong. And I'm like, well, or we really understand the science better than everybody else in the scene. And it's worth mentioning, just throwing it out there, we had a friend of ours go to Florida State University where Gatorade was developed ages ago. And they have like a Gatorade Hall of Fame, and they have some of the original packages of Gatorade. And used to, there was a time when Gatorade provided a gram of sodium per serving. And then over the course of time, that sodium has gotten dialed down and the sugar has gotten dialed up because of this kind of misunderstanding about the importance of sodium and really the hazards of adding sugar to our system.
Actually, that's a, I sound super professional using Wikipedia, but one of the sentences on Wikipedia talks about the importance of sugar in electrolyte drinks for properly supporting sodium uptake. Is that true?
It's true in certain circumstances. So this comes from something called oral rehydration therapy. And what they found, you know, people in developing countries, if they get a dysentery or some of these really terrible gut-borne pathogens, they can get diarrhea to such a degree that they can die quite easily from dehydration and from electrolyte imbalance. If somebody's throwing up a lot, they can die from alkalosis because they actually lose a bunch of stomach acid. So those things are really important. And in that oral rehydration therapy scenario, sugar does facilitate the uptake of sodium. But what's missed in that story is that there are lots of other co-transporters that also allow the uptake of sodium. Amino acids facilitate the uptake of sodium. Butyrate or beta-hydroxybutyrate. So butyrate, if you're eating a high-fiber diet, you're going to make short-chain fats from that, and that facilitates the uptake of sodium. If you're on a ketogenic diet, and this is one of the reasons why I know years ago, there were folks that were really concerned about the lack of fiber and that we would kill, you know, the mucus layer in the gut because we weren't feeding it. But what we find is if we hit a decent level of ketosis, the beta-hydroxybutyrate diffuses into the gut and actually feeds the gut microbiota and some of the intestinal lining cells. That also facilitates the uptake. And this is something that gets missed a ton in this. Under fasting conditions, like medically supervised fasts, the one thing that folks are you know, given to help them navigate this whole process is an electrolyte beverage that is heavy in sodium. But these folks are consuming nothing. And so how do they absorb this? And the body has another backup mechanism. So one, a person in fasting would, in theory, be in a state of ketosis so that beta-hydroxybutyrate could be facilitating the uptake of the sodium. But also, we can bring minerals into the body via active transport. It costs us a little bit of energy, but we can absolutely do that. So it's true that under, you know, kind of life or death circumstances, putting a little bit of glucose in the mix can definitely enhance the uptake of electrolytes, but it's portrayed as if it's impossible to, you know, uptake electrolytes unless you have sugar with it. And that is absolutely patently false. And what we've done with our folks that we work with, it also begs the question, okay, if you're going to put sugar in there, how much? Like, are you a 6'4" male? Or are you a 5'2" female? Are you super active? You know, there's all these different considerations there. So what we do is just educate people about if you are working out at a very high motor, you know, output, and you feel like you would benefit from some additional glucose, then here's how we would kind of dose that alongside your electrolytes. But even in that case, I recommend that people get something like the diabetic glucose tabs, because I like to handle those as completely separate entities. Like, you've got the electrolyte piece, and then you've got the carbohydrate or the glucose piece. And so when I go to jujitsu, if it's all a bunch of old broken down has-beens like me, I will just sip on some electrolytes while I'm doing my drilling and open mat. And it's not really that big of a deal. If it's a bunch of, you know, 22-year-old Division II wrestlers that are now, you know, doing jujitsu, then I'll take 15, 20 grams of glucose, because I would like that extra little pop while I'm training. So again, I know I'm bouncing all over the place with this stuff, but the oral rehydration therapy is a real thing. There's absolutely super important applications for it. And it is completely false that is the one and only way that one can bring sodium or electrolytes into their system.
I'm getting hit with memories. I remember when I first went on a low carb diet, and I was like super intense about it and very legalistic in my approach. And I had a blood test and I fainted, which was really awful. But I remember I woke up and they were like trying to give me like some electrolyte sweetened thing. And I was like, I can't have sugar. So I refused it. Good times. But you touched on so many things. So like, you were talking about how if the body needs sodium, if it can't get sodium, it's forced to excrete all of these other really important electrolytes. Like, I can't really think of any other nutrient where if you don't get enough of it, your body gets rid of other nutrients to balance. I mean, is that the situation that's happening?
Yeah, but I mean, it's a little bit like getting inadequate dietary protein. You know, if somebody is under eating protein, and there are a lot of people both in the vegan world and in the really extreme keto world that are terrified of protein. They're terrified of mTOR and growth factors, and they're going to get cancer and all this stuff. And what ends up happening, these people lose lean body mass, they lose bone density, because a significant proportion of your bones are actually made of muscle. And then organs like your heart and your liver and your brain end up shrinking because your body is catabolizing the protein in your person. Now, some autophagy and some cellular turnover is beneficial for sure. Before COVID waylaid everybody, I had a talk that I was going to do called Longevity, Are We Trying Too Hard? And I'm really on the very conservative and skeptical side of the fasting camp. I think people do too much of it. I think they go way overboard. They should be instead of asking, should I do another 72-hour fast this month, I would ask them, have you done 4 days of strength training every week for the last, you know, 6 months? Like, I think that there's a lot more upside and benefit to be had there. But you know, we do store a lot of different nutrients, protein, electrolytes, you know, both in the bone and in the soft tissue. And when we are depleted in that, if we're under eating those things, then we will strip those out of the body.
You're really one of the only people that I've personally heard talk about with overfasting things like stem cell depletion. I haven't really heard anybody else say that. And I've heard you say it, you know, multiple times on different podcasts, and I've thought about a lot. And I recently interviewed Walter Longo, and I asked him, I was like, is that a possibility? And he was like, yeah. I was like, okay. I don't know. Something I think a lot of people aren't really talking about. Like, we're all about using the stem cells and upgrading the stem cells, but you know, there might be a point where that could be too much.
What people forget is we only have so many stem cells. And this is a whole potentially interesting thing. So both of our girls were home births, and there's this really potent desire to like get the placenta out and disengage it as quickly as possible. But that placenta will continue pumping stem cells into the baby for quite a long time. And that stem cell pool is everything that you're going to have for your whole life. You know, and all these folks that are saying, I'm going to live to 150 and everything. Okay, well, you will, maybe based off of how many stem cells you have. But over the past 30, 40 years, the tendency has been the baby comes out, they clamp the placenta immediately because there's this super misguided notion that the placenta is going to overfill the baby with fluids and there's going to be some sort of like hemodynamic catastrophe because evolution is that dumb. You know, it's like, this is one of these things that just makes me absolutely crazy. But so we have this pool of stem cells that need to last our whole life. And then we have cells that go through growth phases and then different elements of the senescence phase. That senescence can head into autoimmunity, into pro-inflammatory state, and also into cancer. So you don't want an overabundance of those, but something that folks miss is that exercise causes a conversion of senescent cells into either apoptosis, getting rid of them, or back into a pre-senescent state. So it kind of presses a reset button on that. But all of our cells have a certain number of replications. It's called the Hayflick limit. And it may be a little bit different in a full living organism than it is in a tissue culture. But this guy, Hayflick, noticed that after cells had divided about 50 times, they were done. Their telomeres were gone, and they went through a very rapid senescence process, and they died. And one of the hallmarks of when people get pretty old and then like everything just fails all at once is that they have depleted their stem cell pools. But I did my first article on fasting in 2005. And then by 2006, I deeply regretted releasing it because it went out to mainly a group of CrossFitters who were intermittent fasting 22 hours a day, eating 5 grams of carbs a month, doing 6 workouts a week. They would recover with hot yoga on the weekends and their hair was falling out. They had no libido. They had retrograde performance. And I'm like, this is a stressor. And if you're a type B mellow desk jockey who does computer programming all day, doing a little bit of intermittent fasting is probably great. If you're a hard charging athlete who's doing 3 or 4 times the work output that a hunter-gatherer would do, you don't need more stress. And this is where I think folks kind of in this, you know, biohacking community or whatever, they lose sight that all of these things are a tool and all of them have a dose response curve. And virtually everybody thinks that more is better. And it's funny because I was really banging on Peter Attia for a long time. I'm like, dude, I think you're doing way too much of this stuff. And more recently, he is really walked back the volume and the intensity that he's doing on his fasting. And if we overlay also, I know we've gotten out in the weeds away from electrolytes. You look at what Brett Weinstein's work that he did back in 2004. So all of this research looking at fasting and calorie restriction and increased health span is mainly in lab animals. And it's mainly in lab animals that have been bred to what Brett has found, particularly in the rodents, not so much the same application to the primates, but in these mice and rats, they've been bred in a way that they have exceptionally long telomeres. And this has been dangerous for drug discovery because it makes these animals super human, if you want to put that, with regards to toxicity. They can deal with massively toxic environments because they've got a huge amount of telomeres and stem cells that they can deal with things in an acute fashion. But these animals also suffer from massive amounts of cardiovascular disease and cancer later in life because of the evolutionary trade-off with these elongated telomeres. So with the little bit of study that has been done in looking at animals fed a species-appropriate diet, they get absolutely no benefit from calorie restriction. You only see calorie restriction when animals are fed a crappy lab chow diet, which is like the penultimate definition of processed food. Like they're feeding these monkeys and mice a chow that is basically processed grains with vegetable oils and sugar, because the researchers want to know exactly what they're eating, which is laudable on the one hand, but is dumb on the other, because there's not many things that are uncontroversial out in the world, but you know, the notion that highly processed foods are really easy to overeat and can be problematic for health is one of the few things that won't start a fistfight in, you know, the interwebs. And the, you know, the case that I've made and that other people have made is that all of the fasting research that we've seen, all of the calorie restriction research that we've seen, may be doing nothing other than illustrating that eating less of crap food is better than more of crap food. And that may be the alpha, the omega, the whole thing on it. And then when we overlay that with this idea that overly aggressive fasting moves senescent cells through the life cycle more rapidly, which then brings up the stem cells, that sounds like a good idea. But what people don't realize is that we have a whole spectrum of cells that need to function at any given moment. Some of our immune response to cancer involves cells that are partway through the senescent cycle. You don't activate mTOR complex 1 without cells that are in a mode of being partially down that senescence route. And so then we don't develop the natural immunity against cancer or the normal apoptotic processes. So then you increase the likelihood of cancer in many regards if we are overly aggressive on that stem cell depletion and just trying to expunge ourselves of every single senescent or quasi-senescent cell. So I'm in this mode where I think get sun on your skin, drink some coffee, lift some weights 3 or 4 days a week, do cognitively engaging activity, and sure, maybe once a quarter, once a month, do a 1 day, 2 day fast, great. But I am really, really suspicious of any type of additional benefit or upside. And in particular, when I see folks that just look frail and haggard, and that like if they were driving on an icy road and their car went off the road and they would be incapable of saving their own life because they're fasting themselves so hard that they are literally a non-resilient, you know, organism, then that seems ridiculous to me. And I'm totally in the minority on that.
Hey friends, did you know there is an ancient botanical that modern research shows performs on a level comparable to metformin when it comes to supporting healthy blood sugar levels? And not only that, this compound also supports the gut microbiome, healthy cholesterol levels, and even stimulates the AMPK pathway in the body to support cellular cleanup and longevity. You might have heard about AMPK. We talk about it a lot in the context of fasting, which also stimulates it. I am talking about berberine. I take berberine every single day of my life, and I see massive differences on my CGM, my continuous glucose monitor, when I use it. I take it to support my fast and before meals to reduce blood sugar levels. It is a powerhouse of a compound. And like I said, people are prescribed the pharmaceutical metformin to control their blood sugar levels when they could be taking this completely natural compound that has been used for thousands of years in both ancient traditional Chinese medicine and Ayurvedic medicine. I wanted to make the best berberine on the market, so that's why I created AvalonX Berberine 500. We did so much testing to find the most potent, pure, and clean form available. There's no problematic fillers, no common allergens, just pure, vegan, lab-tested berberine extracted from traditional sources. Friends, I am not kidding the difference I see on my blood sugar levels with this berberine. We're talking no post-meal spikes when I eat all that fruit and lower fasting blood sugar levels. It also reduced my HbA1c and my cholesterol levels. You can get it at avalonx.us. And the coupon code IFPODCAST will get you 10% off. You can also get a one-time 20% off coupon code when you text AvalonX to 877-861-8318. That's AvalonX to 877-861-8318. And you can get a 15% off coupon code by signing up for email updates. For that, just go to avalonx.us/email list. Again, friends, this is one of the most powerful compounds you can add into your health and wellness routine. Healthy blood sugar control, even if you're not pre-diabetic or diabetic, is so important, and berberine helps support that. It is the ultimate compound for blood sugar control, cholesterol, your gut microbiome, and longevity. Get it at avalonx.us with the coupon code IFPODCAST.
I think it's really, really valid to think about. I actually just learned the other day that stem cells generate their energy through glycolysis. Do you think that has any implications for people on long-term ketogenic diets?
It could. You know, like red blood cells are exclusively glycolytic in most mammals. And so this is where I think as we've motored along, we have generally found that adequate protein with some degree of carbohydrate restriction seems to be really good. Like the Bernstein diabetes solution for type 1 diabetes works miracles for people. But what they're doing is they're consuming enough protein so that the liver can make adequate glucose via gluconeogenesis and release that, but it releases it in a very steady time index fashion. It's very, very different than consuming any type of a dense carbohydrate source. And we just seem to see fewer of the really deleterious side effects of people trying to be in this like mega deep ketosis where like they have unmeasurable insulin levels and whatnot. Like protein does release some insulin. If you're insulin resistant, maybe we want to find a way to reduce calorie load and carbohydrate load so that we can, you know, restore good insulin sensitivity. But being afraid of protein because of the potential of gluconeogenesis and insulin release, I think ends up being very counterproductive in the long run. And I wouldn't be, you know, wouldn't it be a bastard if we're killing some of our stem cells because we're starving them of adequate glucose? And then when we get to be 80 years old and we really wish we had those to help repair like an aortic arch weakness in our cardiovascular system or something, it's like, oh, sorry, we're all out of those. You know, we're all out of stem cells that could create some more neurons in your brain or some more gut cells to help your gut lining heal or something like that. So this is where I you know, some people for a variety of medical reasons, or like if they're doing adjunctive cancer therapy or whatnot, the really, really deep state of ketosis is something that I think they need and they want to pursue. But then for the vast majority of people, if just general body composition and health is kind of the goal, I think that we make sure that we get adequate protein, we figure out if we run better on carbs or fat, and we find a way that we can spontaneously maintain our appropriate calorie intake. And that's really where the money is. And once people hit that point, I'm so suspicious of the benefits of much in the way of fasting beyond that. Like a lot of zone two cardio, a lot of strength training, a lot of novel cognitive activities like learning to dance or a language or music, like those things, we just have such great research. And it also, it enriches your life today. That's another thing that I'm kind of like, well, it benefits you now and it will probably benefit you later. Whereas this fasting stuff, like, I don't know, if somebody gets in a mode where they're like, well, I just feel really good, it's good for my productivity to skip breakfast and then I do a lunch and a dinner, that's great. That, you know, I have no gripes around that. But when people are compressing their feeding window to like 1 hour a day and they're trying to eat 3,000 calories in a single meal and they've got gut issues from that and their sleep is all disordered, then I think we're really driving the boat in a completely counterproductive position or direction, you know, if the primary goal was supposed to be health.
I'm just mentally preparing myself for all the the feedback and the questions I'm going to get from listeners. Yeah, I've found that I've settled into, it is one meal a day, but it's like 5 hours probably of eating. And I just really, I don't know, I really benefit from the mental part of fasting during the day and the productivity, and then just having a long, luxurious evening seems to work with my sleep. So it's really working for me, but I do wonder about that stem cell stuff.
And you know, that piece doesn't sound so crazy and over the top to me. And honestly, that does better emulate what would generally be accepted as kind of like an ancestral eating pattern. Like hunter-gatherers tended to hunt and gather throughout the day. Then they kind of all got back together in the late afternoon and evening, and they ate the bulk of what they hunted and gathered. And it tended to extend out over a rather long period of time. So that doesn't weird me out. And also, you know, if your hair's not falling out, if you're not amenorrheic, if you're not cold, if your sleep's not disturbed, if your HRV score is good, it's like, okay, we're good. But people will just go crazy and they're like, well, I'm eating in 5 hours. What if I do it in three? You know, and it's just this brinkmanship where they keep making it tighter and tighter and tighter. Yeah.
Yeah. Especially being the host of the intermittent fasting podcast, I think the biggest disservice that has come out of the intermittent fasting movement is that people think it's the one doll, like the be all end all solution. So that because you're fasting, what you eat no longer, like magically doesn't matter anymore. It like kills me. And then the second thing, they think more fasting is always better. So like you just said, but you know, if I can do 5 hours, I can do 3 hours. And if I can do one meal a day, I can fast for 3 days or 4 days. And I don't know. I try to dismantle that as often as I can.
And again, I always have the caveat, if it seems to be working for people, if they look, feel, and perform the way that they want, if they, you know, if it's working for their lifestyle, like if I had my ideal situation, I would do get up, do a really big breakfast, do jujitsu or some type of strength training around noon. And then I would do my final meal around like 2 or 3. And depending on the volume and the intensity of my activity, then I'd be done. But I have 7 and 9-year-old daughters, and family time eating is kind of important. And so I do a big breakfast. My lunch is dependent on if I did a lot of jujitsu that day, then it's another big lunch. If I was writing all day or podcasting, you know, kind of like this, then it's a very modest lunch. And then I just have a token dinner in the evening because we sit down and hang out and talk about the day and all that type of stuff. So I, you know, even though I'm saying all this stuff, I would ideally have a bit more of a constrained eating window, but just like my family obligations and social obligations, it makes it a little bit easier to do this, but I'm really, really flexible with it. Like if we get super busy, the cool thing about fasting and ketosis and all this stuff, in my opinion, is that when people become metabolically flexible, if you're traveling one day and all of your food options suck, you're like, fine, I just won't eat. I'll eat tomorrow. You know, it's like, I'm not going to get wrote, you know, if you're gluten intolerant, then you're like, I'm not going to eat at this sketchy restaurant. I'll just motor through and I'll get a ton of work done and I'll make it up on the back end. That's awesome. Like I think that the liberation that can be had from a metabolically flexible physiology, just you can't make enough about that. But again, I just think that people go crazy on it and institute this kind of brinkmanship where they're like, well, some was good, so more has got to be better. And that's when I start seeing people have some real problems.
Yeah, I think listeners are always pretty shocked to learn. Like the longest I fasted is like 48 hours. And I was like, I'm not doing this again. I tend to eat every single day and I tend to do it in that longer window. I wanted to touch on one thing. I just didn't want to let it slip away. The rat thing you were talking about with the telomeres, was that the thing? I was listening to some interview. I feel like it was Peter Attia. It might have been Brett Weinstein, but whoever it was talking about how basically almost all the studies we've done on rats have been not incorrect, but misleading because of the rat species that was used.
Super incorrect. Like really incorrect, because if this hypothesis around their telomere length is accurate, then what it's kind of been borne out, because we use these animal models as a first line of assessing safety. And then, you know, things like Vioxx and stuff like that. Then we release it out to the populace. And what we find is in the short term, typically people are okay. But when it goes on for 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, then we start seeing these potentially really negative downstream effects. And so Brett's whole case here is that the foundational toxicological screening that they do at the beginning of the drug discovery process is flawed. And then it flaws everything else as a consequence. And he released this back in 2003, I want to say, and it has been very unpopular within the drug industry circles. And this could be something as simple as they need to breed the animals in a different circumstance, and or they need to bring in some wild type animals. Like there could be some ways to modify this so that we could do these things differently, but there's absolutely no will to do that, because it will absolutely limit the number of new drugs that are kind of brought online. But I have a little prickliness around that too, because virtually all of the new drugs that are brought online are addressing issues that are completely solvable via diet and lifestyle. So this isn't addressing like a brand new cancer therapeutic that's going to save lots and lots of people with these rare types of cancers or anything. It's another anti-inflammatory drug. It's another heart drug, you know, stuff like that.
Didn't he like try to tell people about this and was basically just ignored? If they accepted this, it would invalidate.
Yeah, I think he spoke before Congress about how important this was, and it just went nowhere. As his podcast has grown, this thing has gotten a new life and has some more legs. But yeah, it's a really interesting piece to this whole story for sure.
Well, since we're talking about controversy and the findings and the data, coming back to electrolytes, when I was sitting down to research all of this, I was just thinking about how honestly the whole salt debate is something that I find so confusing, because on the one hand, there's all these people saying that, you know, low sodium diets have beneficial effects, especially on things like blood pressure. But then there's a whole scrutiny of the data saying that it's misleading, or it's like U-shaped, or it's J-shaped. But then there's scrutiny of that and saying that that is actually, there's a lot of debate out there. So this controversy surrounding sodium and particularly blood pressure, but other conditions as well. What are your thoughts?
It's interesting. I mean, at a very superficial level, and this is, you know, years ago when we talked about like the amount of fat that was consumed, you know, we were told that fat is this major enemy for cardiovascular disease and cancer and all these different things. And then some stuff popped up like the French paradox and the Spanish paradox and, you know, well, they eat more fat than Americans do, but they have, you know, fewer problems, and it just kind of goes on and on. One, I think that nutrition research is just really, it's difficult to do. It's usually not done that well. It's super complex. But some animal studies that looked at boluses of sodium being given again to animals raised blood pressure. So that was kind of this thing. And they're like, huh, okay. And we know for sure that elevated blood pressure is a major cardiovascular risk factor. It is, depending on where you are in this whole story of cardiovascular disease progression, there are some people that believe that the concentration of cholesterol, specifically lipoproteins, LDL lipoprotein, that is the driver of cardiovascular disease. Other people make the case that that is a piece of it, but you need some sort of vascular damage to occur, like smoking or oxidized fats or oxidized cholesterol or high blood pressure. When our blood pressure is very high, we get what's called non-laminar flow. And so the movement of blood through our vascular system, laminar flow is very, very smooth, and there's not bumps and kind of bubbles through it. But non-laminar flow creates this turbulence that can damage the endothelium of our arteries. And then the cholesterol and the lipoproteins deposit there to begin the rebuilding process. It's actually part of the recovery process. But if that keeps happening, then you can end up with an atherogenic fatty streak. And I'm not entirely sure where I am on the, is it all lipoproteins? Is it vascular endothelial damage? Like I'm the more I look into this, the more I'm honestly confused. But when we look at the research on just what are people consuming with regards to sodium and cardiovascular disease rates, a really simple one, and this is something that when the US government started making low sodium recommendations back in the late 70s, early 80s, some people pointed out that the Japanese consume 3 to 5 times more sodium than we do, but yet had a fraction of the cardiovascular disease. So it can't just be the sodium. And then they did pretty darn good studies, randomized, you know, controlled trials where they would get folks eating low sodium diets and high sodium diets. And what's interesting in those scenarios is that the low sodium diets decrease blood pressure a little bit, but it's really not that much. But what really seems to knock blood pressure down is finding a calorie load and a glycemic load that is low enough that people reverse insulin resistance. And then when they become insulin sensitive, they retain the proper amount of sodium instead of retaining too much. So it is a complex topic, but I mean, the research on both high and low sodium diets have been pretty, I want to say pretty clear, but to your point, you'll have people that get in and pick it apart. And one of the things that I've been recommending that people do is they just get like a $10, $15 home blood pressure cuff. And you just experiment a little bit. You know, let's say you're eating a low carb diet, but you've had some lethargy and fatigue, and maybe you're lightheaded going from seated to standing, which is classic kind of symptoms of hyponatremia, of low sodium. Let's see what your blood pressure is there. Now let's have you eat some olives and some salami and maybe use something like Element. And let's get your daily sodium intake spread out throughout the day from both food and supplement sources. Let's get it at least 5 grams per day and let's see what that does to your blood pressure. And what we find is, you know, people are not like en masse developing hypertension. What we find is that in some cases, people who had hypertension previously, when they consume the appropriate amount of sodium, their blood pressure actually goes down. Doesn't do this for everybody, but there is literature that suggests that inadequate sodium causes stress. And so we get an upregulation of both adrenaline, epinephrine, and cortisol, because both of those are other hormones that cause a retention of sodium. But those things are more stress hormone related, and they have all these other kind of deleterious effects. So it is a big gnarly knot to, you know, it reminds me of when my daughters refuse to brush their hair for a couple of days and you've got this horrible tangled knot. And I'm like, I'm going to have to shave your head to fix it. You know, this problem, these nutrition problems strike me as being similarly messy and tangled, but we do have some pretty good research to lean on. And also that kind of N equals one experimentation. Like if you're concerned one way or the other, then, you know, for a $10 or $15 investment in tracking your blood pressure, then you can figure out where you are in that story.
So the tendency to having hypertension or blood pressure issues, is that something that would most likely only manifest if you are eating a diet that would create that? Or if you are genetically predisposed to that, does it not so much matter? Like, could you be following an appropriate diet and still have blood pressure issues?
Little bit of both. There's definitely a genetic component. There's definitely that epigenetic component of diet. But by and large, we tend to see hypertension track really closely with insulin resistance. And when we fix that insulin resistance, then we tend to see that resolve. And there's maybe 1% of the population or what we would call a sodium sensitive hyperresponder. Like they get a really massive transient increase in blood pressure when they eat a salty soup or something. Like they get they can feel it. They can feel their blood pressure has gone up. Not all of these people respond favorably to reduced glycemic load, but most of them do. And what's interesting about those other folks is that if they're eating a lower glycemic load diet, they're not experiencing any of the symptoms that you would need more sodium for anyway. They're not experiencing lethargy, fatigue, elevated heart rate. Like, their body is at a homeostatic level that's fine for their situation.
Hi, friends. I have very exciting news. So I know you guys already know and love Element and understand the importance of electrolytes for hydration, energy, focus, supporting your fasting, your workouts, all the things. Guess what? Element has a product that goes beyond electrolytes. What is it? Well, so I am very pro the benefits of caffeine. I love the cognitive benefits, the longevity benefits, and that said, I am a slow caffeine metabolizer, so I don't actually take in lots of caffeine. I've also learned that the form, dose, and balance of caffeine makes a huge difference in how you actually feel. That's why I am so excited that Element has launched a brand new lemonade iced tea. It's refreshing, delicious, lightly caffeinated, perfect for summer, and what I really love is the science behind it. So instead of relying on massive amounts of isolated synthetic caffeine like so many energy drinks out there do, Element Lemonade Iced Tea uses a full black tea extract, so alongside the caffeine, you naturally get compounds like L-theanine and polyphenols. The L-theanine actually helps smooth out the stimulant effect for a calmer, steadier energy experience with less spikes and crashes, while the polyphenols provide antioxidant support as well. And you guys know I am all about the antioxidants. And the incredible team at Element, including my personal hero, Rob Wolf, conducted a meticulous amount of research to find the perfect amount of caffeine, which is the sweet spot for sustained focus and energy without feeling overstimulated or wrecking your sleep later. That is exactly 50 milligrams of caffeine. On top of that, they knew that caffeine can increase your need for critical minerals like sodium, potassium, and magnesium. So that's why Element Lemonade Iced Tea pairs the perfect amount of caffeine with a meaningful dose of electrolytes to support optimal hydration and performance. And of course, Element Lemonade Iced Tea is completely free of sugar, artificial colors, and all the other stuff that you do not want that are so commonly found in caffeinated drinks today. It's built on the same science-backed electrolyte formula that Element is known for, with sodium, potassium, and magnesium in ratios designed to support hydration and energy production. The result? You get your perfect pack of portable, easy-to-make lemonade iced tea that provides steady, clean energy that tastes delicious and actually feels good. As you guys know, Element is trusted by neuroscientists, functional medicine practitioners, professional athletes, including the NFL, the NBA, the NHL, and they're even used by Navy SEALs and the Marines. So are you ready to up your drink level with the ultimate lemonade iced tea? You can get it. And when you get it, get a free 8-count sample pack of Element's most popular drink mix flavors with any purchase. at drinklmnt.com/Melanie Avalon. That's right, a free 8-count sample pack of Element's most popular drink mix flavors with any purchase at drinklmnt.com/Melanie Avalon. Find your favorite flavor or share it with a friend. And by the way, Element has an amazing no questions asked refund policy, so you can try it completely risk-free. If for any reason you're not satisfied, they will give you your money back. Again, go to drinklmnt.com/Melanie Avalon for a free 8-count sample pack of Element's most popular drink mix flavors with any purchase, including their new lemonade iced tea.
Yeah, I was reading a review. It was effects of low sodium diet versus high sodium diet on blood pressure. Is it called renin or renin?
Renin, yeah.
Renin, aldosterone, catecholamines, cholesterol, and triglyceride. It was 2017, and it looked at a ton of studies. But the biggest takeaway for me was just the massive difference between, because you're talking about how they do studies on sodium restriction diets, and it doesn't have, you know, a huge measurable effect on blood pressure. But it seemed to be that the biggest difference was whether or not you had hypertension originally. And if you did, then it has like a much bigger effect. Although I read the whole thing and they didn't comment on this, but I thought this was so interesting because they were looking at it by race. So it was Asian, white, and black. The Asians had the smallest change when they were normal. So if they didn't have hypertension, they saw the smallest change in blood pressure when they went on a low sodium diet. But on the flip side, they had the greatest change if they had hypertension. So they were like on both ends of the spectrum. I was just wondering, like, do you think it has something to do with their metabolic health?
I don't know about metabolic health, but there's definitely some adaptations there. Like in general, Asian populations tend to show much lower rates of lung cancer in conjunction with smoking. So, I mean, this is where some of that more granular genetic stuff becomes important, and like maybe doing a little bit of genetic testing to figure out, you know, some of your SNPs and polymorphisms could be helpful. But this is also where just doing a little bit of N equals one self-experimentation is super helpful. And I may modify this position going down the road, but right now, if somebody is hypertensive and they're like, do I need Element or electrolyte supplementation? I would say no, but I would really like to see you modify diet and exercise in a way that we improve your insulin sensitivity, and we can track that via a variety of ways. I really like the LPIR score, or the lipoprotein insulin resistance score. And then let's see where you are then. Like, have we resolved the hypertension at that point? And, you know, this gets out in the weeds a little bit, but in Chinese medicine, there's this recognition that the lungs and the kidneys are really tightly related. And you're talking about like renin and angiotensin and whatnot. Some of these hormones are produced in the kidneys, but make their way to the lungs to be activated. And there's some, this may be some of the benefit of like mindfulness and breath work, is that it may modify the way that these blood pressure regulating hormones actually, you know, regulate our electrolyte status. There's not a ton of research on it, but mechanistically, it makes a lot of sense. But this is where understanding our genetic and epigenetic situation is really valuable, but it's also doesn't mean that our genes are our destiny. Like, we can get in and do some tinkering and modifying, but it also makes the case that although someone like me, I really benefit from some aggressive sodium and electrolyte supplementation, somebody else may not need that stuff because just genetically their body is wired to hold on to sodium more effectively, and they may be, even when eating a very, you know, healthy glycemic load for them, they may be at that borderline of the hypertensive state. And so they would really benefit from some zone 2 cardio, some sauna work so that they're getting that low-level cardiovascular effect and really tuning up their sweat glands for excreting sodium and whatnot. So there's a lot of different ways to tackle that so that people can customize it to meet their individual needs.
I don't know why I'm just so haunted by it. I guess it's because, like, you would think with the Asian population, since they see the smallest change on reducing their sodium, that if they are hypertensive, that they would still see, out of the three races, out of Black, Asian, and White, that they would also see the smallest change, even if they're hypertensive. But the fact that they see the greatest, why? Like, is it that they normally have something, like you were talking about with the Asian diet, and like Japan and having a higher salt intake, like they're genetically protected against it. But then if there's, for some reason, if they have hypertension, like is there some like one thing that is off that would explain it? I don't know. I'm getting in the weeds now with it.
I suspect that this is just, no, it's a really, really good question. And I do not have, I don't even have a great speculative answer on that other than we do see some ethnic driven differences in different disease potentialities and whatnot. Like within the medical risk assessment program that I've been a part of in Reno, where we found 40 police and firefighters at high risk for type 2 diabetes. And we used this LPIR score as some of our advanced testing. We modified their diet and lifestyle as best we could, like kind of a lowish carb paleo type diet, got their sleep as dialed in as was possible given the demands of their work. And we had really dramatic changes in their metabolic health. The program ended up saving the city of Reno. It was estimated to be $22 million prorated over 10 years. It was like a 33-to-1 return on investment. But within that population, we modify, like if someone is African-American, we modify the cut points more aggressively for what we want to see, both with glycemic control and with blood pressure, because within African-Americans, at the same some borderline high blood pressure, you see more kidney damage and you see a higher likelihood of vascular events in African-Americans than you do in Caucasians and Asians. And this is all like super controversial stuff these days. Like you're talking about trying to save people's lives and now people on the interwebs have gone so crazy that you can barely even talk about this stuff. But you can have two people, different ethnic backgrounds, same height, same weight, same blood pressure, borderline high, and one of those people is at a higher cardiovascular disease risk and a higher kidney disease risk because of their genetic predispositions. Now, somewhere in that evolutionary story, those folks that are at higher risk for that have an advantage somewhere. Like there's some, this is where biology is all about trade-offs. If you're super fast twitch, you may make a great basketball player or sprinter, but you're going to be a terrible marathoner or triathlete. And so, you know, it's not that there's anything wrong with any of these people. This is just the genetic bag of, deck of cards that they were dealt. And we have to better understand what's going on there. But we purposefully modify the cut points more aggressively because if we don't, we know based off of like MESA data, women's health study, the nurses' health study and whatnot, that African-Americans are at higher risk for different complications at metabolic cut points that are more benign in Caucasians or Asians.
Speaking to that, just to paint a picture from this study with the sodium change, and I'm using the word black because that's what they call it in the study. White people who did not have hypertension, who went on low sodium diets, saw a reduction of 1.09 millimeters per mercury. Is that the way you would phrase it?
Mm-hmm. And you could just call it 1 point. Yeah.
White people with hypertension was 5.51, but then black people who did not have hypertension was 4.02. So almost the same as white people with hypertension. And then black people with hypertension was 6.64. And then that's where the Asians were like on the two different sides. So without hypertension, it was 0.72, but then with hypertension, it was 7.75. So the intuition surrounding all of this. You were talking about how there is an evolutionary advantage to things, even if they seem like they might manifest as a health condition or a bad thing. But, you know, somewhere along the line, there was an evolutionary reason for it. So when it comes to electrolyte intake and intuition, how intuitive are our bodies for getting adequate amounts of electrolytes? Like with Element, for example, should people just take a pack, and if it tastes super salty, does that mean something? like how do people know how many electrolytes they need?
Sure, that's a really good question. And honestly, it's one of the most difficult things to answer. People say, how much do I need? And it's like, I really don't know. Are you a large male, small female? We spent 2 years living in Texas where on Christmas Day, it was 90 degrees and like 90% humidity. Now we live in Montana, you know? And so all of those things change the parameters a lot. Even within very mainstream guidelines, the American Council of Sports Medicine athletes that are training in hot, humid environments or at altitude and at high work output, they put the need at least 7 to 10 grams of sodium per day. So this is super mainstream, orthodox, you know, medical circles, and they recommend for an athlete that, you know, we started having the conversation at least 7 to 10 grams of sodium per day. We've done work with like professional hockey teams and some other folks that really track the electrolyte loss for these folks during a game or a session. And some of these big guys that are what we call super sweaters, like the sweat just pours off of them and they tend to have a much saltier sweat, they will lose 10 grams of sodium in an hour, hour and a half game or practice. And if they don't replace that, they are a disaster. Like they don't recover, they don't sleep. So there's just a massive spectrum on this stuff. And you know, your question is really good. Like what's kind of the intuitive or qualitative, you know, thing that we could use on this? And one of the things to look at is just being aware of the signs and symptoms of low electrolyte status, hyponatremia, and lethargy, fatigue, brain fog are all kind of early stage pieces. When we start getting cramping, like you lay down at night and you go to stretch your toes out and your calf cramps, like you're really far down the track of low sodium and low electrolytes. Like you've gone really far on that. So cramping is an indication that we are really sodium and electrolyte deficient. Some of these other things like lethargy, brain fog, high heart rate when we go to lay down to go to bed, low HRV score, these are all very consistent with that. And we have noticed this is very unscientific. There's absolutely no randomized control trials to support this. But what we've noticed is that if folks mix something like Element and they put it in, say, like 32 ounces of water, so not super concentrated, but it's not super dilute, what we find is that when people are in need of additional sodium, all that they taste is sweet. And then when they hit a point where they're kind of topped off on sodium, they start tasting the salt and it really, they're kind of like, I don't know that I really want anymore. So it takes a little bit of paying attention to some of those subjective symptoms like the lethargy, brain fog, fatigue, cramping, and then paying very, you know, pretty close attention to how something like this tastes. Now, all that said, we do also recommend that people get it as much of the sodium as they can from other dietary sources. Things like pickles and olives and, you know, salami and stuff like that are really, really good sources because you get a bunch of other nutrition along with the ride. Element is fantastic. Love it when people buy it, but I'm really not envisioning that people get their full sodium allotment from Element. I'm really hoping that they get the vast majority of it from their diet based around whole minimally processed foods that some of them also come with a decent whack of sodium.
Just looking at what I eat a massive amount of seafood, oftentimes scallops. And with the amount that I eat, it actually says that I get, quote, the RDA for sodium because I eat so much of it. Another question I had, though, about the sodium and the intuition, does the body reach different homeostatic baselines of sodium based on what you're eating? I tend to eat very simply in that I have like the certain types of foods that I like, and I go through times where I'm eating a lot of one type of food and then a lot of another, but the consistency is there's always high protein. I play with the macros, but sometimes I go through saltier phases and with the actual food itself. And I feel like I will like hit a baseline. Eating that amount of salt won't make me feel like I ate a lot of salt. But then if I'm on a lower salt run and I eat a salty meal, I mean, I massively feel it, you know, and I'm like sweating the next day and excreting water. Is there like a timeline of a adjustment where the body adjusts to salt intakes? And then a follow-up question would be, would that make the argument that not minimum effective dose, but like if the body does reach some sort of baseline, is it better to be at a lower or a higher baseline, or does it matter?
Man, those are great questions. Your questions are going to be 10 times better than my answer. The kidneys are really quite good, all things being equal, and we're not metabolically, you know, we're not suffering metabolic derangement and insulin resistance and whatnot. The kidneys are really good at sorting out our sodium intake. If we go a little too much, they will filter it out, excrete urine, and all is kind of good. Usually what you will notice with that is possibly an increased thirst. Ages ago in sports circles, the coaches would tell athletes and kids to suck on salt tablets and then just sip on water per you know, satiety. And this was actually a really shockingly smart recommendation, you know, because you had the sodium there that would stimulate the desire to drink water, but then you weren't diluting the sodium to such a degree that we ended up in a hyponatremic state. So the body's pretty good at regulating that side of things. And then that minimum effective dose story, I guess there's something to that, but it seems like, again, it strikes me as a pretty dynamic process. Again, I'll just use the example of living in Montana. Like we are at 3,000 feet elevation, so not real high, but certainly not sea level. But typically it's pretty dry here. But the past couple of days, we had some thunderstorms. The ground was absolutely saturated with water. And then the sun came out and it was like 94% humidity and 85 degrees. Like it felt like Costa Rica or Texas or something like that. And I noticed that my baseline desire for electrolytes was much higher, like much, much higher, because I was just sweating a lot. Hot weather is so infrequent in Montana that we don't even have an air conditioner. Like you just open your doors and windows in the morning, the house gets cool, you button it up, and then it carries you through the whole day. Whereas like it was hot outside, it was hot inside, I was sweaty and uncomfortable all day. And I noticed that my electrolyte intake was much higher than what it was otherwise, just like my desire for it. So it's a good question, but I think that is just a really dynamic, changeable process, depending on what your situation is. You know, like being on an airplane, you would make the case that you would probably want to hydrate like crazy because the air is super dry, and dry air tends to ironically lead to dehydration, which is a loss of the water, and we tend to see an uptick in sodium excretion. But what do you not want to do when you're on an airplane? Run back and forth to the bathroom like 30 times during the flight. So you know, there's a, you know, just the dynamics of life, I think, are going to be huge drivers on that. So I probably did a terrible job answering that, but I think it's just a very dynamic process.
It's a very nebulous concept. It's probably like so many things I talk about. It really is just an individual, you know, there's not like one answer. And like you said, it's dynamic and changing. Just to clarify, the level of using electrolytes for hydration, is that also on a spectrum? Like, do electrolytes support hydration up to a certain point, but then if you have too much, would it support dehydration?
A solution could be hypertonic, where it has more things dissolved in it than what is dissolved in our body. And like if you drink a hypertonic solution, you can get really bad gut ache and possibly even diarrhea from that, because it will actually pull fluid out of the body to dilute it in the intestines. And so that would be a problem. There's isotonic, where it is the same amount of dissolved solutes in that water. And that's kind of like the nice sweet spot. And when people put element in about 30 to 32 ounces of water, it's about a hypotonic solution, slightly on the hypotonic side. And then the hypotonic is where this is kind of where people end up with Gatorade and most of the electrolyte options that are available. They have electrolyte in them, but they are such small amounts relative to the fluid being consumed that it really doesn't help you. You still ultimately end up in that hyponatremic state, because although we don't want to overly lose body water, which would be dehydration, you also, it's arguably much more dangerous to end up in a hyponatremic state, that sodium-potassium imbalance, than it is dehydration. When you look at the medical literature, unless somebody is like trapped in a mine cave-in, or they get lost in the desert or something like that, nobody ever dies from dehydration. Like humans will find a way to get some fluid in themselves, but people routinely will overconsume water. Again, you know, like these hazing rituals with fraternities and sororities, military training, marathon, triathlon, where people will drink a set amount of water every 2 miles or whatever. and it's absent electrolytes, and they can end up in a hyponatremic state and be hospitalized or potentially even die.
I'm so glad you touched on that, because I was actually wondering that if, and it's a really naive question, but I was wondering if like Element had to be dissolved in water, or could you just add it to food, for example?
The balance is important, but you know, some people have been using, I mean, it wouldn't in my mind be much different than using salt on like a steak, or like some folks were putting the mango chili on watermelon slices, and it's like otherworld. It's so good. So, I mean, it can also just be a seasoning too.
Okay. Are you thinking of making any like non-drink one seasonings?
We haven't really thought of that too much. We've just been spinning up recipes with the ones that we have, and like, oh yeah, you could use it with this or use it with that. But we haven't really thought about like a seasoning line around that. No.
Well, listeners, get really excited, because I'm sure they want to get their hands on some Element. And you mentioned this already, but you have the most incredible, amazing offer, which is listeners can get Element a sampler pack completely free. That's how you know that it's a good product that people keep buying, if you can afford to give it away for free.
It's like a drug dealer. So long as you get the first one's free, and then people are hooked. So yeah.
Then no more. So you can go to drinklmnt.com/Melanie Avalon, and there you will get your free sampler pack. So thank you so much for that. And then you've made it clear that you pay a small price for shipping, but if you don't like it or don't find it beneficial, they will even reimburse you for the shipping, which is crazy. Do you have any exciting new flavors down the pipeline? You probably can't share, but you guys have so many flavors, it blows my mind.
We had grapefruit that came out for the summer, and it was a seasonal flavor, and it sold out in like 3 weeks. We were stunned by that, and it apparently is our most popular flavor, and we thought it was only going to be a seasonal, so we're figuring out what we're going to do with that. And we will have a really fun holiday/fall flavor that's going to be a ton of fun. And that's all I'll say on that. Yeah.
Can I make a flavor request?
Absolutely.
This doesn't even apply to drinks, so you're not going to make this, but birthday cake. I would be so excited. I love everything birthday cake.
So I don't know if you're into Star Wars. My kids are into Star Wars, but there's this blue milk. It's kind of this feature of Star Wars. And we were kicking around the idea for like May the 4th that we would. So we don't add any colorings to any of this stuff, but we were thinking about doing a May the 4th blue colored electrolyte, just so that people could have their you know, May the 4th Star Wars electrolyte deal. But that too would be a limited run, and would use like blueberry extract as the color. So yeah, it's a possibility. We'll see.
I'm a huge Star Wars, Star Trek girl, so that'd be so exciting. Well, thank you so much, Rob. This has been absolutely amazing. I'm just, like I said, forever in awe and grateful for everything that you do. I listen to every single episode of your podcast every single week. So having this conversation now is just really, really surreal. The last question I ask every single guest on the show, and it's just because I realize more and more each day how important mindset is. You might remember it from last time, but what is something that you're grateful for?
Oh, it's probably the same answer, but definitely my family. Like that's right up there. And my health also. I've learned recently that two classmates, you know, I'll be 50 in January, but I had one classmate, mother of four, grandkids, et cetera, et cetera. She died from COVID. And then another really dear friend, the person that I actually walked with at graduation in high school, had a massive stroke and died recently. So can't say enough gratitude or have enough gratitude for just being healthy and having some people foolish enough to love me. So that's what I'm grateful for.
Well, thank you so much. Like I said, any other links you'd like to put out there or anything we didn't touch on, or how can people best follow your work? All of that.
RobWolf.com is where most things live. They can find the Healthy Rebellion, Healthy Rebellion podcast, and then over at drinkelement.com, like we generate a massive amount of material, like our guides to intermittent fasting. We talk about a lot of these, you know, pluses and minuses about how to do it, how to keto fuel different athletic activities, but we have a massive amount of material over at drinkelement.com.
Perfect. Well, I will put links to all of that in the show notes. Thank you so much. This was absolutely amazing. Enjoy the rest of your day, and hopefully you can come on again in the future.
Anytime you want me on, I will do it. Thank you.
All right, thanks. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. For more information, you can check out my book, What When Wine, Lose Weight and Feel Great with Paleo-Style Meals, Intermittent Fasting, and Wine, as well as my blog, melanieavalon.com. Feel free to contact me at podcast@melanieavalon.com. And always remember, you got it.